Kildare today.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Kildare's KFM.
Now, the Psychiatric Nurses Association General Secretary Peter Hughes has said the sector is enduring a recruitment and retention crisis in both mental health and intellectual disability nursing. A shortage of psychiatric nurses due to emigration and retirement is having an impact, he said, at every level of the mental health services. Indeed, he was addressing their annual conference, which was held in the last couple of days. But other issues arising in regards to concern that we should have are patients in the Central Mental Hospital being forced to sleep in clothes due to extreme cold, and psychiatric nurses, psychologists, mental health campaigners calling for urgent action to address a continuing shortage of child inpatient psychiatric beds. Let's talk about some of those issues now, where we're joined by Peter Hughes on the line. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Clan.
Good to talk to you again, Peter, and thank you for joining us. Now, we'll address the shortage of staff in a couple of minutes' time, but some of those issues that have been gaining traction in the last couple of days, the shortage of child inpatient psychiatric services, with HSE figures supplied to the Irish Examiner showing there's been a 40% drop in admission to the four public child and adolescent mental health services known as CAMHS approved centres in the last year due to staff shortages?
Well, due to staff shortages, nursing staff shortages mostly, there is a reduction in the amount of beds in the country for child and adolescents. Division for Change in 2006 provided for 100 beds. We've never reached that target. 72 is the highest. And we're now down to 43 beds nationally. So there are no beds to admit young people into at this stage. And we know that just down the road in Lindara, last May, 11 beds closed, and those beds were due to open last September. They haven't opened, and there is no prospect, by the looks of it, of them opening this September either.
Yeah,
so it's 14 months now Lindara has 11 beds closed.
And that's 24 beds down to 13, I think, at this stage, as you've just said there. Now, those cutbacks were due to be reversed last September, but still remain in place a year after they were announced.
Yes, there's been no improvement in the staffing numbers. It will take at least 16 more nurses to open the unit that is closed. We're seeing this around the country. We have the unit in Cork has 16 beds registered, but is really operating on 6 beds. We've seen a reduction of from 20 beds to 14 beds in Galway, and a reduction in St Vincent's and Fairview from 12 to 8 beds. So it's just the beds are closing, demand is growing, and the waiting list is getting longer. And December 2020, there was 2,755 on the wait list. There, at the end of February this year, 4,434 on the wait list. So the demand is growing, but the supply is not improving. The supply is diminishing in beds. I'm not advocating that beds is the only solution, but the community teams, also as Provision for Change, are operating at approximately 60% of what staffing levels they should have.
And the HSE says that these cutbacks and the continuing reduction in operational beds is due to what they call high levels of nursing staff vacancies, but they said there continues to be a concerted recruitment campaign. We'll talk to you specifically about that in a moment. Peter, just one other story is that the Mental Health Commission has written to the management at the new Central Mental Hospital in Portrane after it alleged patients were being forced to sleep in their clothes due to issues with the heating system at a facility that cost €220 million. In April, records released under Freedom of Information legislation revealed that staff had raised concerns about what they called the extreme cold at the hospital 25 times over a 33-year-day period after it opened last November. Now, it's bad enough that in the new proposed children's hospital, which is costing in excess of €2 billion, that we have many of the theatres in the hospital are still not ready to function. But this is unacceptable, is it not? In a facility that costs €220 million.
Well, yes, it's not acceptable. It's my understanding that that issue is resolved. That would have been, as you know, the forensic service opened in November last year. But it's my understanding that matter is now sorted, is resolved.
All right, that report emerged yesterday in the papers only in regards to that. And after the issues with temperature control at the hospital came to light in April, when the family of a patient claimed residents were being treated as what they called subhuman, the Director of Regulation at the Mental Health Commission wrote to the management of the hospital about it. But if it has been resolved, we'll be pleased indeed.
Well, it's my understanding, but we certainly will check that out.
Yeah, I mean, but when you talk about a €220 million facility, it's difficult to understand why then you emerge with problems with the heating system, for God's sake.
Absolutely. It's not acceptable that you're talking about a brand new state-of-the-art facility, that there won't be any issues with heating or any other areas in respect of that.
Right, that National Forensic Mental Health Service Hospital was built on the campus of the former St. Eitan's Psychiatric Hospital in Portrane, replacing the 171-year-old Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum. Now, Peter, back to the staff shortages. You were addressing your conference last Thursday. You said the sector is enduring what you call a recruitment and retention crisis in both mental health and intellectual disability nursing. We've highlighted some of the issues there. How chronically bad is it?
Well, just the conference was a little bit earlier in the year, but the report at the conference, we did a survey of our branches throughout the country, and we have 700 vacancies in the mental health services. To me, that is the highest we've ever had. And it's a result of, I think, a number of our younger graduates emigrating because they had 2 years of COVID, that there was no emigration, and some are now going, and also retirement. Some people that could have retired during COVID stayed on to support services, and a lot of them are now retiring.
But isn't it also
it's a major crisis.
Is it not also to do with quality of life, terms and conditions of work, and in terms of that? Because just like in the general hospital sector, many nurses are emigrating because they feel they can get better terms and conditions and quality of life abroad.
Well, that is true, particularly in the likes of Australia and Canada would be mostly where our nurses are emigrating to. And the pressures of working short-staffed and being reliant on overtime obviously has the impact on staff as regards burnout, and that becomes intolerable, and it's growing. And so therefore, there needs to be a stop put to this. One area that I think needs to be seriously looked at is subsidised accommodation for nurses. If you go back to the 1980s, you used to have accommodation for nurses in nearly all the psychiatric services around the country. That is not there anymore. And we have a situation, particularly in the Greater Dublin area and the other cities, where not only can the nurses not afford the accommodation, they sometimes can't even get the accommodation. So that is something that needs to be done. Like if we look at Lindara, for example, we have one unit closed for 14 months at this stage. The savings that are made in not having those staff for that unit should be reinvested and into providing some sort of subsidised accommodation to attract staff into the services.
But it's one thing to have, even if it were subsidised, and you've hit on the point yourself there, mentioning it in passing, is the availability of suitable accommodation. Surely what might address it more directly, if accommodation blocks were built on the grounds of hospitals, is there any room to do that around the country?
I would certainly advocate that. Before going back to the Central Mental Hospital and the forensic services in Portrane, at the outset, 6 years ago at this stage, one of the first things we tabled was that when they were building the hospital, to build staff accommodation nearby. There is a lot of space in the grounds of St. Eitan's. There's acres of land there, and they could have done that. And that would have really helped as regards staffing for all the North County Dublin area and the Greater Dublin area. But that was not taken on board. And it's still not too late to use those grounds and to use other grounds that traditionally had psychiatric hospitals for building staff accommodation.
Well, we'll be using...
I'm not saying it should be free accommodation, but definitely subsidised.
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in another context, about housing, the number of derelict houses on the Curra Defence Forces facility later in the programme with Independent TD Cathal Berry. And final question, Peter, how good or bad is morale throughout the psychiatric service?
Well, morale is low and has been for a number of years now because of the shortages. Because, as I said, it becomes intolerable for people to work constantly, reliant on the agency, overtime, and working short. And it's really pressurised. And at the same time, there doesn't appear to be any urgency with the HSE to resolve the issues as regards recruitment and retention, as to have, you know, as I say, look at inventive or incentive ways of addressing this. And the first one I think that you should really look at is the subsidised accommodation. And to retain, we have to retain what we have, but we also have to attract people in.
Obviously.
But the people here to keep hearing of services being short, it's not exactly the best of advertisements. So it really needs to be addressed as a matter of urgency. It is something that just cannot be put on the long finger, because in my experience, I think it's actually going to exacerbate rather than improve, unless we do something urgently to look at. As I said, the Greater Dublin area, we have 40-50% vacancies in most of the services in the Greater Dublin area.
Oh, that's amazing. 40-50%, that means that a system basically is functioning in what could be described as a crisis and emergency situation.
Yep.
So those are the issues around the psychiatric services, and in particular, the most urgent need of all to address the staff shortage in the sector. And General Secretary of the Psychiatric Nurses Association, they're Salinsbay. Are you still Salinsbay, Peter?
Yes, Glenn, yeah. We're
all
still
right.
down in the waterways.
All right, good to talk to you again, Peter, and thanks for your time
all
this morning on the programme, and good morning to you. Let's go north of the county now, where we're joined by Labour Councillor Ciara Galvin. Good morning, Ciara.
Good morning, Glenn.
You want the council to provide an update on the pop-up pool in Leixlip. Tell me, what is a pop-up pool?
A pop-up pool is a temporary pool structure that we gave Swim Ireland some money out of our local property tax budget to bring it to our municipal district in Salvage and Leixlip.
Is that kind of like the kind of thing you might see Aldi and Lidl selling, like sort of, have in your back garden?
You might think that, but it is. It's a 12.5 metre pool, so it's half a standard size pool. It's good depth. They're doing a lot of good work in it at the moment. There's been a lot of classes and just various groups who maybe otherwise wouldn't have access to the pool have been using it, and there's been public swimming areas as well. So, the whole idea of getting the pop-up pool is that we'll have a report at the end of it that will kind of show that we really desperately need an actual permanent pool facility in the area. So my question is, we're about halfway through our time with the pop-up pool now in Salvage and Leixlip, and my question was, you know, what kind of usage is it getting? Because obviously we want to maximise the usage to really show that we need this facility. So the answer that I got back was that there's been 79% overall uptake on slots since launch day. And some slots, and there's been a lot of people in there, children with special needs, traveller groups, teenagers with additional needs, women's groups, aquarobics, older adults, parents and toddlers, wheelchairs, people with wheelchairs, adult lessons, children's lessons. There's summer camps on there at the moment. And
where is it based? Where is this pool?
It's at the GA Club in Leixlip. So if you're coming from Selbridge,
Ciara Galvin, the GAA.
Sorry,
my GAA. God, I've had to bless myself when you called them the GA.
I don't know. I've always called it the GA.
I know. There's people out there now who have dropped on their knees.
Well,
and implore the Lord to let Ciara Galvin see the light. The GAA. Sorry, go on.
In the car park of the GAA club over in Leixlip, not far from the motorway interchange to Selbridge. So it's really very accessible. It's a very nice little pool. And I would encourage people to visit if you can, because obviously we want to up that in that.
Is there any commercial pool in North Kildare?
There are a couple of commercial pools, yeah. There's one in the Glen Royal. There was one in St. Raphael's, a special school.
Are they available to the public?
They're not really, no, not anymore. I mean, I used to do lessons in St. Raphael's when I was growing up in Selbridge, but I don't know if they're back again after COVID.
You know, there's a beautiful pool in Athy, and it's often intrigued me that you have this beautiful public pool in Athy, and rightly so, by the way, just in case anyone says it shouldn't be there. But it's always intrigued me that in the most populated part of this county, where Selbridge, Leixlip, Maynooth, the populations have absolutely boomed in those areas, and I throw in Kilcock or whatever, that there is no public pool in the guise of the lovely pool that's in Athy and wonderful. But anyway, that campaign.
And Naas as well. Naas actually has a very nice public pool as well. It's just the northeast of the county.
Yeah, well, that's what you get for calling it Ga now. You're not getting a pool until you mend your ways up there. Okay, what about youth facilities in Selbridge? You wanted a progress report on that.
Yeah, so this is something I've been working on. I'm on the steering group of that. So really, I just wanted to get this on the agenda so that all the other councillors will be up to date as well. So there was a consultation carried out in Selbridge in May and June this year with 121 teenagers. There was workshops. They developed models for the facilities that had been identified as the ones that are wanted in the consultation that happened last year. So there's things like multi-use games areas, teenage playground and outdoor gyms, and also something called a handout area. I'm not sure what that is exactly. So they will now be used to form the basis of a tender to have these facilities designed. And I asked on Friday kind of what the timeline is on that, and it may depend on the availability of whoever gets the design, but hopefully the designs will be done late this year or early next year, and then we'll be able to move to the build phase.
Okay, good stuff. You had a question in relation to the walled gardens. Tell me a little more about that.
I did. This one was actually related to a motion that I tabled that was barred from the agenda.
No, I want to talk to you about that particular motion. Yeah. Why you brought a motion to the council asking to meet the council meet with the owners of some land around Castletown House. Am I correct?
Yes. So I asked that the councillors would extend an invitation to the new owners of lands beside and behind Castletown House. To discuss concerns raised by constituents about the lands. This is a very controversial issue in Selbridge at the moment. There were lands behind Castletown House that I think a lot of people assumed were in public ownership, but they weren't. They were always privately owned. And those lands were sold last year to another private owner. And people are wondering, like, why didn't the OPW buy the lands? And the answer is that they did bid on them, but they were outbid by this new owner.
Now, let me tell listeners that the motion you brought was that councillors extend an invitation to the new owners of the lands behind and beside Castletown House and parallel to Castletown Avenue to meet with the councillors to discuss concerns raised by constituents about the lands. Now, we'll talk about what are the concerns in a moment, but your motion was ruled out of order, and that tell us why.
Yeah, I didn't really expect it to be, Clem. I never had a motion ruled out of order before, but it was ruled out of order because it was considered not the business of the municipal district to be inviting private companies to talk to us, and that it could be seen as essentially usurping the proper planning process. So they said that companies can, the initial response I got was that companies can request a pre-planning meeting, and if there are issues or developments on the site, they should be reported to the planning department. So that pre-planning meeting would also be with the planning department. So councillors don't have a role in that.
So basically, if I might just summarise that answer, what the reply you seem to get saying that this is not the concern of the councillors, it might undermine the planning department, and that if there are issues around the land, the planning department will deal with that. What briefly are the concerns raised by constituents about these lands?
So I put up a post on one of our local Facebook groups just to gather the concerns of people, because this has been going on for weeks now. There's 7,000 signatures on a petition about this, and so it's not something I could really ignore. So I asked, look, what are your concerns? And there are a number of concerns coming up. There's 5 different ones. There's the access to the walks used for decades by people who live around there on those lands. There's access to the house and car park, because the access to the car park goes through the lands that were sold. And there were questions about tree felling and biodiversity and the maintenance of open green space. A number of people had a particular concern about the ancient woodlands on that site, which is obviously a concern because there's only 2% of our country has ancient woodlands on it at this point. A couple of people were asking, would the new owners consider selling to the state? Others were asking, why did the new owners put up signs saying land's poisoned when they apparently weren't poisoned? And then finally, a lot of people were asking, what are the outline plans for developing on the site now?
Are we sure the owners put up those signs, by the way, about the land's been poisoned?
Yeah, we are. We are fairly... like it went up after the things, and they have actually spoken to another local representative, Rita Cronin. She's a TD, and yes, apparently they told her that the lands weren't poisoned, but they just didn't want dogs off lead. Now, that's third hand, but that's what...
All right, well, we can check that with Rita, yes, and Rita would be a regular listener to the programme. She might let us know if that's what she was told in regards to that. So essentially, the situation anyway at the moment is in abeyance, because the council are not going to meet the owners or the company around these new lands. So how do you proceed with those concerns?
Well, I'm not really sure, Clem, to be perfectly honest, because of those 5 or 6 concerns that were coming up, only one of them really was related to planning, the outline plans for the development of the site. And because my motion was barred, I wasn't able to say that at the MD meeting. And I mean, yes, people want to know what the plans are for the site. The answer is there are no planning permission. There's no planning permission sought on that site. The land is zoned open space and amenity. There's a very limited number of things that planning permission can actually be sought for on that site. So we could potentially have had a meeting about these other issues and leaving out anything. And I did specify this in my revised motion. I specified that it would be to exchange information on the understanding that neither side will seek to influence the other on matters properly addressed through planning or other functions of the council. But it was still rejected, and it's very frustrating, Clem, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I have to consider my position carefully, because certain other concerns were given in the decision of the appeal committee when they barred my motion. And they pointed out, like, the code of conduct for councillors, we have to be extra careful when dealing with planning matters, so as not to compromise the statutory process. We have to do things like meetings in a transparent fashion. We have to follow due process. Like, that's not optional. That's something we have to do as councillors. So I'm not sure where I'm going to go from this, but I'm not going to drop it. I just need to give it some more thought.
All right. Okay. Nothing like a woman scorned, I say, in regards to Councillor Ciara Galvin. Keep in touch with us on that, Ciara, because I think there's a rather big issue in the making there, particularly in such a beautiful facility as Castletown House, and with lands going into private ownership. We've seen that before around golf courses, and I'm thinking of parts of the coast in the south of Ireland where public were precluded from going, rights of way that had often existed no longer existing and stuff like that. Yeah. So there's general interest in this particular topic. Councillor Ciara Galvin of the Selbridge Leixlin Municipal District, let us know as that progresses, Ciara, if there's any more developments. And thank you for talking to us this morning.
Thanks, Ken.
All right, still to come on the programme, we're going to be speaking with the Irish Pharmacy Union. Would pharmacists be able to actually write prescriptions? Should they be able to do so? Or must we still going to see our doctors who will sign his or her name onto a prescription for, you know, the usual 60 quid or if you have to see the doctor, and maybe an additional 15 quid to write the prescription and so on?
Kildare Today with Clem Ryan.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
All right, some of your messages then. Thanks for getting in touch. We were talking about cowboys and Indians and that some of us used to play when we were kids. And I was saying about, you know, you were really in the... if you had the two guns in the holster and stuff like that, and you were the Lone Ranger. Didn't have a horse, mind you. But my mother's brush, often, my mother often came to the door, come back with my brush, where are you going? did the same when I went to live with my nana, I have to say. You remember that as kids? You take out the brush with the long handle, the sweeping brush, and you'd ride up and down the road. Come on! And you'd be beating yourself in the backside, you'd be black and blue. You'd only realise afterwards that you were hammering yourself rather than the horse in regards to that. And the listener reminds us, yeah, and we had cap guns. Yeah, are they sold anymore, the rolls of caps, so that when you pulled the trigger, it made a little sound? The old cap guns. I must check. I know an old shop in Ennis, very, very old shop, that seems to stock a lot of that old stuff. I must go in there one of the weekends and ask them, do they have any cap guns or rolls of caps anymore that we used to go and buy in regards to that? Another listener says, doctors and these experts should stop using BMI as a guide. My previous GP would constantly comment on me being considered fat due to the BMI, but he neglected to realise that the medication he prescribed had caused a lot of the weight gain. That kind of attitude needs to stop, says Carissa Innes. Agree with you there, Carissa. That's something that's not often taken into account, is it? That medication can be such a contributor to body mass index and people putting on weight, saying, it's the tablets I'm on. Liam Kenny, good morning to you, you wonderful historian, you. Great to hear you back on the airwaves, Clem, while Owen has his break. We might have a chat next week pinpointing some highlights for Heritage Week. Indeed we will, Liam. Because we'll be marking Heritage Week ourselves over a course of 10 days, and we'll be playing all our little town histories and our famous Kildare people again on the hour, or certainly on every show throughout the course of the day. Anyway, look forward to talking to Liam. Teoch na Nina Kilcullen. Does anyone in Kilcullen know when it's going to open? Asks Bridget. Teoch na Nina, which translated from the Gaeilge would be the people's house. Not sure which one you're talking about. I don't want to appear picky or grumpy. Oh, I always know when someone says that they're going to be picky or grumpy. Would you please tell Caoimhe that there is no such colour as cerise yellow? Caoimhe Harney, are you out there? She's possibly on the phone at the minute, but I'll get on to her again.
I'm here.
You're there. A listener says that they don't want to be picky or grumpy, but they are. That they're saying that there's no such colour as cerise yellow.
I know, I was saying it's the equivalent of cerise pink. So I just called it cerise yellow.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Okay. There you are. You wouldn't want to know Caoimhe, no, I'm telling you, lads. Eat Sound Farmer and all of that. Don't bug our Caoimhe.
I apologise to the listeners. But yeah, no, like it's just okay. A bright, you know, it's a bright yellow, isn't it, Clem?
All right. I don't know. What are you asking me
you
for?
You are, because you can see me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, it's a bright yellow that you have on you. Lovely bright yellow. We had to turn off the lights in the studio. And Gareth said, okay, thanks for that, Caoimhe. Anything else bothering you at the minute, no?
No, nothing.
Clem, good to hear you back. Thanks very much indeed. Whinging about RTE all the time, says Mick and Mead. Like the old saying, you make your bed, you lie in it. He says in regards to that. Clem, also, did you see the documentary in Channel 4 last night about human... Oh, no, I didn't see that. Oh, no. Human meat? No. Loved the Cowboys and Indians, as a listener, with the boys next door. Better fun than the dolls in prams, says Rose. Now, Caoimhe, you liked your Cowboys and Indians too, didn't you? She was saying anyway, she's gone again. God almighty.
No, I'm here. We have a listener waiting on the line, Clem.
I know. A listener or a guest?
Our guest.
All right. I'm suitably chastened in regards to that. So let's go to that listener on the line. I beg your pardon. Anne-Marie Horan, who is in Vice President of the Irish Pharmacy Union. Good morning, Anne-Marie.
Good morning, Clem.
Sorry, Anne-Marie, I forgot there when I was
discussing. That's okay, no problem at all.
Cerise yellow and cerise pink and all of
well,
those.
These are important discussions.
They certainly are. Now, a task force has been set up to look at how to expand the role of pharmacists. I, for one, without taking sides in this, feel that the role of pharmacists in Ireland compared to other countries is very much underused.
Yes, no, that's totally true. I mean, international evidence shows us that pharmacists can be much better utilised than we are at the moment. And we are willing and able to do more for our patients. So like in Scotland, where the pharmacist first is established, it has operated since 2020 and there's been over 2 million consultations. So they would do things like minor ailments, oral contraception, they would, you know, extend prescriptions, and that kind of thing. So there is, like, international evidence would show that we can do much more, although we do need to be properly reimbursed. In 2009, our fees were significantly cut, and we've had no increase since then. So we really do need fee restoration to be able to do everything that we want to do and to serve our patients well.
But when task forces are set up, very often, you know, these go on and on and on and on. How confident are you that this task force might eventually... I mean, we have pharmacists who administer the pandemic vaccinations, did we not? We also have pharmacists who administer the flu vaccinations. Surely it's not beyond pharmacists, you know, if a prescription needs to be extended or whatever, to be able to write that, to preclude people going to GPs. Said GPs already saying that they're being overwhelmed by numbers coming to them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, 8 years ago, I'd never given anyone an injection. And in the last few years, I have literally given thousands of COVID and flu vaccinations. So my job has changed so much from when I started. And, you know, it's exciting and that a profession can evolve. And the healthcare sector in Ireland needs all the healthcare professionals to evolve and to do more because, you know, we're at crisis point and things need to change. And certainly pharmacists, I really do believe, could help deliver a revolution in patient care in the community. So I certainly hope that this task force will not be a talking shop. The Minister, Stephen Donnelly, does seem to be enthusiastic about it, seems to be very positive and seems to really want to push it in the right direction. So certainly, I mean, I listened to him yesterday on Pat Kenny, and he seemed to have a lot of enthusiasm for the project, and he seemed to be very committed to it. So I hope with his enthusiasm that he can, you know, encourage this task force to have good findings and, you know, to get it over the line. And so that it isn't just a talking shop and it does give real results because, you know, we really would like it before next winter. You know, last winter was pretty hard for people and anything that takes pressure off the health sector at any level will benefit us all.
I think there are very few people who disagree with you with that about reducing the demand on hospitals, walk-in clinics and GP practices as well. One final question for you, very briefly. All sectors and all professions can be very territorial in terms of protecting their interests. Would you envisage that there might be any opposition from the GP sector in regards to allowing pharmacists to undertake these prescription duties?
I think that, you know, I suppose change maybe is uncomfortable for people at some level, but I do believe that pharmacists and GPs work very well together. You know, a pharmacist had their doors open all through COVID and we really served the community well, and we would have had, in COVID, we would have changed our relationship with GPs in the sense that they were sending prescriptions by health mail. So, you know, I think pharmacists and GPs have a very good relationship and this relationship evolves. And the reality is, you know, that the IPU commissioned an independent survey that saw that if pharmacists were doing more, that this could save over 1 million GP appointments. And the reality is GPs are run out the door. You know, they are really, really busy. And pharmacists doing more